Let's talk about the people who love Emerson and why, starting with you. And I'll even give you my own two bits.
I love Emerson because he taught me, first of all, since I care passionately about American literature of the highest imaginative quality, and in particular about its poetry. Without Emerson, there would have been no Walt Whitman. There would even have been no Emily Dickinson, even though she's a sort of heretic from Emerson, but nevertheless deeply affected by him, as she says. But Walt Whitman remains the New World's answer to the Old World. In the entire centuries now, no one writing in the Western Hemisphere, whether in Spanish, Portuguese, in French up there in Montreal, or anywhere in American English or any kind of English, no one is not in some sense the child of Emerson, whether they know it or not. And of all of those writers, the most powerful in all of those languages remains Whitman. And Whitman, though he later tried to deny Emerson's influence and said, and it was a lie, he said, I hadn't read a single essay of Emerson before I started to write Leaves of Grass. He tells the truth in his journals in 1854-55, where he says magnificently, I was simmering. Emerson brought me to a boil. And you can see, if you look at those fragments, which I've studied very closely in the 1854-55 notebooks, out of which Song of Myself, as it came to be called, eventually directly ensues, and the whole of the first Leaves of Grass comes, you can see that without the essays, the oversoul, spiritual laws, the poet, and self-reliance in particular, there would have been no Walt Whitman. And, you know, I regard myself as a very American literary critic. My mentor in this was my late friend, whom I still miss, the magnificent Kenneth Burke. Kenneth and I, on many occasions, when we were drinking together, would say to one another, we are both the children of Emerson, and that is absolutely true. If you are an American critic, provided you are not a Southerner, if you are an American poet, if you're an American novelist, as somebody like my friend Don DeLillo knows perfectly well, every moment of transcendence that breaks into white noise, that breaks into underworld, is quite frequently directly paraphrased by Don from the pages of Emerson.
The question about Emerson is, I mean, there's this rumor about that Emerson never read Moby
Dick. Do you remember, let me break in a moment. Yeah. I doubt that very much, by the way. Though on the whole, Emerson did not like novels.
That's the question.
Emerson loved poems, he loved essays, he loved wisdom writing. He did not like novels.
And he was not really cordial with either Melville or Hawthorne, I mean, at the end. I mean, in the net.
After he went to Hawthorne's funeral, he personally mourned for his own walking companion, but he said, as for his books, they are good for nothing. What he made out of Moby Dick, we will never know. But I think he did read it. On the other hand, first of all, I would insist he get the permanent high marks as a literary critic in the entire history of American literature. One of the things which makes my life impossible is that every single day they flow in upon me at three different addresses, and yeah, I'd hear unsolicited manuscripts, proof copies, so on and so forth, you know, asking for endorsements, so on and so forth. I mean, I am beleaguered, and to try to read through this stuff, and I've largely had to give up because I wouldn't be able to do any of my own work or lead my own life at all. Think of what Emerson did. What would I make of, I have to ask myself sometimes, if there suddenly arrived in the mail, without preamble, something from a personage, Walter Whitman Jr., of whom I had never heard, in this weirdly hand-printed, hand-designed volume, in these extraordinary kind of alliance. Emerson sat down, read it again, and wrote, I think, the greatest critical document in American history, a letter to Walt Whitman beginning, I greet you at the beginning of a great career, and going on talking about the fact that this is the finest piece of wit and wisdom yet written in the United States, which I believe is true right down to the present day, Emerson included. Emerson was a charismatic. I have read description after description. Emerson, you know, supported himself as a lecturer.
A performance artist, really.
A performance artist. He had immense stamina at it. I think in one year in particular, he went all over the United States and Canada, and it wasn't easy to travel in those days, and gave 88 separate lectures for money, usually in series on every subject under the sun. We have many accounts of people who went to hear him. He evidently was a total charismatic. He could so speak in a kind of high, sweet, beautifully modulated, piercing voice that the audiences were invariably sold out. I mean, he was, in fact, an amazing kind of phenomenon. William James wrote two essays on Emerson, which are full of great love for him. Henry James wrote several different things about Emerson, including, you know, in a book about his childhood. He's really quite snobbish about Emerson. He's saying, you know, it's very sweet New England-like, but it's very provincial stuff and so on. But the answer to that is Isabel Archer. Isabel Archer, who is surely the most delightful personage in all of American fiction, and certainly in James, is the purest Emersonian imaginable, quite overtly. And if you contrast the way he presents her in the original edition and then his immense rewriting of it for the New York edition, she becomes only more Emersonian. The language of self-reliance is absolutely her language.
Take that apart a little bit, yes. Because Isabel Archer, I love her too. The movie to me completely miscast exactly that Emersonian point about her.
The movie had the gorgeous Nicole Kidman, but I wouldn't go see it because I just could not think of Nicole Kidman as Isabel Archer.
Well, not only that, but this victim and this Freudianized female. To me, Isabel Archer defines herself as this Emersonian when she tells Mrs. Touchette she wants to know the rules. And Mrs. Touchette says, so you can break them. She says, no, so as to choose.
Yes.
But the idea of a self-made person
choosing,
living with her mistake as she does, that's my Emersonian notion of Isabel. What's yours? What makes Isabel Archer Emersonian for you?
Exactly what you've just said, that she is the heiress of all the ages, as James says, that she is the American Eve, except that Hester Prynne had been that before her, just as Emerson always spoke of the American Adam. And Whitman incarnated that American Adam for him. We were all invented by Emerson. You cannot be, it seems to me, a person of literary or speculative imagination in the United States of America, unless indeed you are a Southerner and hate him as the devil. Mm. But you cannot exist without being Emersonian, whether you know it or not. He, in the deep sense, he has invented us. In fact, Whitman, as usual, put it better than anyone else. In a long letter to Emerson, which he prefaces, is it to the second Leaves of Grass? I'm not quite sure about that. He says of Emerson, "You are the explorer who went before us and discovered the shores of America," which is a marvelous phrase. There cannot be Thoreau without Emerson. There could not be Miss Dickinson without Emerson. Indeed, she was rather chagrined in the course of her life in various magazines and newspapers. 6 or 7 of her poems were published anonymously. Every single time, everyone thought they were by Ralph Waldo Emerson. The affinity between the two is that great. Mm. And I've always found it fascinating that Whitman had the courage to go directly to the Fountainhead and send the book to Emerson and a long, complex, and at times admittedly rather difficult relationship started between them, though it culminates beautifully. Whitman describes his last visit to Emerson. Emerson had already been senile, had Alzheimer's for years, and Whitman visited the household, and he says that he had stationed his chair so that he could have the best look of that beloved face and just stare at Emerson's face. And then later when Horace Traubel said to him, "What finally is your attitude towards Emerson?" Whitman replied magnificently, and Whitman himself was crippled by a stroke. He said, "Loyal at last." And that is beautifully said. Mm. I mean, Henry James, he condescended to Emerson, but never stopped learning from him. James is an Emersonian novelist. Millie Feel is as Emersonian as Isabel Archer is. She is perhaps a more refined version, a more elaborate version, though not perhaps as vital a version as Isabel is. The Bostonians is a profoundly Emersonian novel. Even the parts of it that satirize are basically satirizing Emersonians. I mean, I hardly know, in a sense, where it ends. Wallace Stevens, if I can think of one phrase which utterly typifies Wallace Stevens, it is that again and again he calls the poet or the man of imagination the scholar of one candle or the scholar of a single candle. That is the great sentence in the essay Society and Solitude by Emerson, which I now quote verbatim: a scholar is that single candle which the love and admiration of all men will eventually enkindle. Emerson is everywhere in Wallace Stevens. Emerson is everywhere, of course, in Hart Crane. We can't get away from Emerson, and we shouldn't try to. I don't know that I would go as far as Richard Poirier, who thinks that the greatest writer the United States has ever had is Ralph Waldo Emerson. I would say that it is certainly Whitman. One would have to talk about Henry James. One would have to talk about Emily Dickinson. One would have to talk about Hawthorne and Melville. One would certainly have to talk about William Faulkner, the greatest, of course, of the Southern writers. One would have to talk about Wallace Stevens and Hart Crane. Robert Frost, of course, is hardly even worth talking about. Magnificent poet, but the most overtly Emersonian writer in our history. At times, as he happily says, he just versifies Emerson. And he called Uriel the greatest Western poem ever. And like his friend Edwin Arlington Robinson, their mutual favorite book, which they used to meet and discuss together, was The Conduct of Life, which is a hard, driving, tough, very tough book.